America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is a great day in part because the ongoing hush money trial in New York City is in recess at the moment. It is going to resume tomorrow with more cross-examination of the one and only Stormy Daniels. So how has that gone so far? And what about the other trial that is pending, the one in Florida? This one, a federal trial involving so-called classified documents. Or were they unclassified by President Trump in some kind of secret move? In that trial, President Trump won a clear victory yesterday because it's going to be postponed and almost surely will not begin in time for conclusion before the election. What does all this mean? Are either or both of these trials biased? Andy McCarthy certainly thinks so. He is the legal expert at the National Review. He's a senior fellow at National Review Institute. He has served as an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. And he joins us, as always, a great honor to have him on the show. So, Andy, a lot of people are reviewing Stormy Daniels' performance yesterday on the stand with her questioning and then the beginning of her cross-examination. I know that that's not a legally appropriate thing to do, but it's almost inevitable in this situation. How did she do?
Well, I think her testimony was shocking, but I'm more interested in that regard, Michael, not so much in her demeanor as the proposition that the prosecutors offer and the judge admits into evidence, supposedly as proof of false bookkeeping violations in 2017, graphic testimony about extramarital sex 11 years earlier that is not relevant to the things that are disputed issues in the case in terms of proving up the charge that's actually filed in the indictment. I think it's hard to look at it as anything other than an effort to dirty him up with some really appalling evidence.
You make the point that it's well known that Alvin Bragg, the district attorney, and the judge in this case, Judge Juan Merchan, are partisans who are affiliated with the Democratic Party. And how could the prosecutors have handled this case in a different way that would show less of a partisan intent simply to damage President Trump in this trial?
I don't think it's possible that they could have brought this case in a less partisan way, because this case wouldn't be brought against anyone other than Donald Trump. The notorious reputation of Alvin Bragg in New York, well earned, is that his default position is against aggressive prosecution. So he's better known for pleading felonies down to misdemeanors or pleading them down to something that doesn't require an actual prosecution in the sense of charges and prison time. And he's one of these, cookie cutter progressive prosecutors who inveighs against the carceral state and the like. So, his default position is not to prosecute. And this particular case, which does not involve a serious crime, in New York, falsification of business records is normally a misdemeanor. He's had to do mental acrobatics in order to try to turn it into a felony, both because he needs it to be a felony to get into the statute of limitations period, because he delayed so long in bringing the case that the misdemeanor statute of limitations long ago lapsed, probably in 2019. And he needs to be a felony in order to make it at least look like a worthy case, because I think most people would say if you're going to prosecute a former president of the United States, no matter how you may feel about him personally, it ought to be a serious case supported by compelling evidence, and this just isn't. So I don't mean to push against the premise of the question, but it's hard. I'd be answering it in an artificial way if I supposed that there was some way he could have brought this particular case in a less partisan way, because that implies that it would have been brought against somebody else who wasn't Trump.
What about the fact that President Trump, since 2016 at least, which is a long time ago, he allegedly had this affair, very brief affair with Stormy Daniels in 2006. He has denied everything. He says he barely knows her. And
B-E-A-R-L-Y? I just want to make sure.
Yes. I think people would agree he barely, B-A-R-E-L-Y, is much more likely. But for a prosecutor or for somebody who is a Trump critic, Bill Clinton, after the proof came in, he finally admitted that he had an inappropriate relationship with Monica Lewinsky and did all kinds of public expressions of regret, and it didn't seem to hurt him at all. Do you think that in retrospect, Trump's aggressive insistence that everything that that Stormy Daniels recalls is a lie, that may have been a mistake in his handling of this embarrassing situation?
Well, it's hard to know without knowing, like, what he's dealing with at home. I mean, as a lawyer, my advice to everyone is always don't lie, you know, especially if you have the good fortune to live in a country which many people in the world don't, where you have no obligation to speak to the police, then don't lie. So, you know, I think it's always a mistake to plant your feet on something that isn't true. But at the same time, I think it's important to distinguish criminal liability from fitness for high office. I think if you look at what happened in the Stormy Daniels escapade here and broaden it out to the lens to the things that Bragg is covering here, there's a lot of reason to think Trump is unfit for office, which is just like another brick in that particular wall. That, unfortunately, that gets conflated with whether he ought to be prosecuted criminally. And I think, you know, I'm pretty clinical about criminal prosecution, probably because besides the fact that I was in the business for 20 years, when you're in the business for 20 years, almost everybody that you're thinking about prosecuting is a bad person. So you're able to, like, filter that out of the equation and then think about the case in terms of what's your evidence and what, you know, what are the statutory elements of a crime that you have to meet. It should be a much more clinical exercise than do I like this person or don't I? You should expect not to like the person.
You have a few more moments, right?
Sure.
Okay, yeah. I want to get into the other case, the classified documents case, and the now very controversial judge, Eileen Cannon, who handed Trump a big victory yesterday. There now is a petition to try to get her to recuse herself from this case. Is there any substance to that? We'll continue the conversation about Trump's trials with Andrew McCarthy of National Review coming up.
Here's a special discount, 50% off just for being a MedHead annual member. Join today at michaelmedved.com. We'll be right back.
And on the Michael Medved Show, Newsweek magazine is reporting that petitions calling for the removal of Judge Eileen Cannon from Donald Trump's classified documents trial have now amassed to more than 300,000 signatures. Cannon was appointed by Trump to be a U.S. District Court judge. She's facing calls to recuse herself from the former president's classified documents case over concerns regarding her impartiality. I'm speaking to Andrew McCarthy, who is a senior fellow at National Review Institute and a contributing editor at National Review. Andy, is there any substance to these challenges to the impartiality of Judge Cannon on the classified documents case?
Yeah, I think they're absurd. If people scrutinize the record, Judge Cannon has ruled in favor of the prosecutors a number of times in this case, including on important matters to Trump, like moving to dismiss the indictment and the like. People who are familiar, Michael, and I think we talked about this when this case was first indicted, those of us who've been involved in litigations that involve the Classified Information Procedures Act, which is a very complicated federal provision and essentially requires that all admissibility issues about classified documents have to be worked out prior to trial, and also gives people a right to appeal pre-trial and even during the trial in some instances. I said right after this case got indicted that I don't see how on earth it would get to trial this year, not because of anything to do with the election, just because of the sheer difficulty of working through complicated classified information issues under circumstances where Smith didn't need to do this. He could have tried this case. He probably could have pushed it to trial quickly if he had contented himself with bringing an obstruction case. But he decided he needed to bring 36 10-year felony classified information counts under the Espionage Act. And when you do that, you not only open up a can of worms in terms of the defense's discovery of the government's case, the defense is also allowed to propose classified information that they want to put in their defense. And all of that has to be hashed out pre-trial. It takes a very long time, even when people are pushing very hard to get to trial. And in this instance, Judge Cannon, unlike the government lawyers, seems to understand that Trump is actually entitled to be present for these proceedings. It was these Democratic lawyers who decided to bring four different cases against Trump, strategically timed so they would be in the months before the election. But due process allows a defendant to be present and participating in these proceedings. So I don't know what they expected here.
And what do you expect? What happens with, in other words, it matters, obviously, who wins the presidential election. The federal cases, like the one in Florida, President Trump's new attorney general, if he wins re-election, could conceivably drop the case, no?
That's possible. And then what would happen is, let's say he fires Jack Smith at 12:15 p.m. on January 20th, right? I would say by the following, I don't know what day of the week that'll be, but by the following Tuesday, the House will have impeached him. And then we won't even have to wait till February for the first impeachment, Michael. We'll be right in it in January.
Do you think even a Republican House, even if it maintains its Republican orientation by one or two votes, that they would impeach the new president?
Probably. If the Republicans maintain control, I've been assuming the likelihood is that the Democrats will take the House just because of redistricting, not just because the Republicans haven't seemed to be able to, govern.
So what would be the grounds for impeachment?
That he directed a case against himself that it was found by a grand jury to be dismissed by the Justice Department and therefore engaged in self-dealing. I also think if he tried to pardon himself, I think the pardon would be legally effective, but my position on all this has always been the pardon is lawful because the Constitution allows the president to do it. It's an unreviewable act, but he can be impeached for abusing his power. So You know, it's not like they had no weapons to push back.
The more serious case, and the most serious case, the one that has the most implications for the future of functioning American democracy, it seems to me, is the other Jack Smith case for election interference and for President Trump's attempt, which was a pretty serious attempt, to overcome a certified and very closely inspected election. That if they were going to go for impeachment and he was going to start dropping cases against him that were federal cases, wouldn't that be the one they'd probably fight over first, ahead of the classified documents?
Well, I don't think you have to, you don't have to say one or the other. They can do both. I've always thought that the classified documents case is a very serious case, I think, and especially on the obstruction part of it. And frankly, Smith's problems are of his own making. He could have indicted an obstruction case in Florida, and he might already have gotten to trial because he wouldn't have to deal with all the classified information issues. The only thing that would be relevant are whether the documents were marked classified, not what was in them. And he might still be able to get to trial in Washington. You know, Trump's counsel in the Supreme Court gave a lot of ground in terms of what in the indictment is private activity that's not amenable of a immunity claim. If Smith agreed to, like, just go to trial on what Trump admits is private, or what his counsel admits is private, I don't know if the counsel told Trump what he was conceding there, but you know, you could get to trial in that case. He has indicted very ambitious cases, and it was irrational for him to think he could do that and push the cases to trial on a short leash.
So what do you think? Do you think that Trump, obviously he's going to be tied up with the hush money trial for another 2 or 3 weeks. After that, is he going to be spending more campaign time in the courtroom?
I think so, but it really does depend. I mean, it now looks like the Georgia prosecutions by the boards, because the Court of Appeals is going to relook at the disqualification issue on Fannie Willis. So we really are talking about the other two federal cases. A lot comes down to what the Supreme Court decides on the immunity and obstruction issues. But I think, Michael, not to beat a dead horse, but a lot also depends on whether Jack Smith is willing to streamline his cases if it's important enough for him to try to push them to trial. If he's not, then these cases are not going prior to Election Day, and this may be this ongoing trial, the Alvin Bragg thing, may be the only one we see.
And 65% of Americans think Trump will be found guilty in the hush money trial. Do you agree?
It's a terrible case, but, you know, the important thing in a trial is how's the jury reacting to the judge and the prosecutors, and we don't have a read on that. I don't have a read on that.
Okay, we will check back with you. Coming up on the Medved Show, why do more and more American men not... Well, Todd Rundgren's singing there about banging the drum all day. Why? Because he doesn't want to work. And there are increasing numbers of men who don't want to work. Some of these statistics are just incredible. Somebody who has written about this and analyzed it and made sense of it, and a good person to respond to this situation, which is not a good situation. His latest book is came out in 2016. It's called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. And right now there's a big piece in Newsweek, rising number of men don't want to work. The U.S. has a major issue, they declare. of prime age men giving up and permanently leaving the labor force. Why is this happening? Nick Eberstadt is a chairholder in political economy at the American Enterprise Institute, where he researches and writes extensively on demographics and economic development generally, and more specifically on international security in Asia. Again, the author of Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. How bad is it? They begin this piece in Newsweek by talking about the difference between today and 1950. In 1950, 97% of men of working age were working. 97%. And today, the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that that has dropped to 89%. What's changed?
Michael, thank you for having me back. It's even more disturbing than that. If you look at the number of men within this prime age group, the prime of life, 25 to 54, who have paid work, the work rate today, they just released it last Friday, so it's pretty current. The work rate is actually a little bit lower than it was in the 1940 census, the first time we ever measured this thing, which, of course, you recall, was the tail end of the Great Depression. So we have a late era Great Depression style problem with work in this country, although today, unlike 1939, early 1940, today we've got a labor shortage. Today we have millions and millions of jobs that are still going wanting. So it's not a lack of jobs that's caused this, increasing problem in the USA.
It's not a lack of jobs. It obviously is, at least in part, a lack of will. One of the other statistics that is just shocking to read is that in 1960, there were 455,000 workers on Social Security disability benefits. Yeah. That has gone from 455,000 to 7.6 million, and mm-hmm. most of them men.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, I don't want to ruin your day, but it's actually worse than that, because we have a crazy quilt of disability programs in the United States that don't play nice with each other, that don't report to each other. There is no office in Washington, D.C. that can tell you exactly how many people in the United States are on our many different disability programs. Back in that book you mentioned, in Men Without Work, I tried to estimate it by looking at different surveys. The best I could figure out was that somewhat over half of America's prime unworking men were receiving at least one disability program benefit, sometimes multiple program benefits, and about two-thirds of them lived in households that were getting at least one benefit. Now, that does not prove that our disability programs are causing this phenomenon, but they are certainly helping to finance it.
The phenomenon is concentrated in people without a college degree. Is that right?
It's disproportionately less educated, less skilled people. However, about 40% of the men who are neither working nor looking for work have at least some college. And about one in five has a college degree. Among the people who are high school dropouts, there's a really mixed bag. If you are a foreign-born high school dropout who's married, your odds of having a job and being in the workforce is about the same as a native-born college grad. If you are a high school dropout who was born in America and has never been married, you've barely got a 50% chance of even being in the workforce. So it's not the lack of a high school diploma per se that is keeping people out of jobs. There's something else going on, too.
Well, that raises a very interesting question. Is the problem that people without work can't get married, or is it the problem that people who don't get married don't work?
Michael, I think it probably goes both ways. I think there's probably causation in both directions. But I can tell you from looking at these numbers, one thing is very clear. No matter what your ethnicity, no matter what your education, whether you were born in this country or not, if you are a guy and you are married, you are more likely to be in the workforce. You're more likely to have a job. There's no particular magic in a wedding ring, but the wedding ring, I think, is a marker for a whole set of attitudes and outlooks and behaviors and motivations.
Okay, if we want a higher percentage of people to go to work, take some of these jobs that are crying out for people to accept them, and we want to pay a little bit less in disability payments and various welfare programs to cover people who don't work, what is maybe one or two steps that we as a society could take to change this situation?
Well, the president of the United States, no matter who he or she is, isn't going to be able to fix the family. And I think the breakdown of the family, unfortunately, has a lot to do with where we find ourselves today. But in terms of levers you can pull and buttons you can push, certainly we want to do more with skills for people. I'm not talking about college. I'm talking about what we used to be able to call vocational skills. That's politically incorrect now, as you know. It's supposed to be career and technical education. You don't have to go to college to have the skills to have a great paying job and support a family. That's one thing. Of course, you mentioned the disability morass, the archipelago of programs that unintentionally are incentivizing people towards helplessness and dependence, which is the opposite of their original intent. I think we need a wholesale reform of those and to put into place a work first principle there. If we did that, it might be more expensive than what we're paying for now, but I have a sense we'd be trading a bigger problem for a smaller problem. We also have about 25 million people who are ex-cons in the United States. We need to figure out ways that we can get some of them back to work who paid their debt to society. We haven't done very well at that.
Nicholas Eberstadt, he is the author recently of East Asia's Coming Population Collapse. Also, Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. He's with the American Enterprise Institute and always informative. If conveying disturbing news, we'll be right back on the Medved Show.
Michael Medved.
Michael Medved Show, when you look at the trials that President Trump is facing, most of them have to do with either his business relationships or his presidential leadership, that one particularly impacting the trial that he's going to be facing at some point or another about trying to undo the results of the election of 2020 by questioning the results. In any event, only one of these trials, and the one that's going on right now, has to do with President Trump and alleged sexual misbehavior. He's not on trial because he allegedly had an affair with Stormy Daniels. He's on trial because he used phony accounting and gave false records about his legal expenses, when the money was actually used to try to buy her silence about their affair. But meanwhile, when people look at the situation, of course they should recognize, and they do, that President Trump is not unique. We've had many presidents. He is unique in many ways, and in one way that I'll mention, but we've had many presidents who have either been accused or it's been proven that they were inappropriately sexually active while married. And that goes back, if you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, to Warren Harding, who had a extramarital affair that carried over into his White House service. It has to do with Franklin Roosevelt, who had very deep involvements, again, that carried over to his presidency with Lucy Mercer Rutherford and with Missy LaHand and others. Of course, it had to do with John Kennedy, famous for it, Bill Clinton, famous for it, Lyndon Johnson, almost certainly. What's unique and different about Trump? All of the various entanglements that in which he became involved, including Stormy Daniels and including the breaking apart of his first two marriages and charges from a whole host of women, all of it has occurred before he became president. The presidency seems to have reformed Donald Trump. Is that true? This is the subject of a new podcast that we have posted on Substack. It's entitled Not the First, But Still Unique, having to do with the fact that we've had other presidents with sex scandals, but Trump is rare in that regard as one of the very few who has none of those encounters occurring during his presidency. Go to michaelmedved.substack.com and take a look at that argument, which I think is relevant. We were talking with Nick Eberstadt about people who declare disability. And the fact that we now have 7.5 million through the Social Security system alone who are not working and receiving disability payments. And one of the questions would be, will Miss USA join these ranks? Now, the story today is sad, it's alarming, but it's very revealing of one of the biggest problems we have in the country, which is mental health. Noelia Voigt, who was crowned Miss USA in September, said this week that she was stepping down from the role to prioritize her own mental health. Voigt, who represented Utah in the 2023 pageant in Reno, Nevada, said in a statement on Instagram that resigning was a tough decision. In life, I strongly value the importance of making decisions that feel best for you and your own mental health, said Miss USA. Voigt, who was born in Florida, said she was the first Venezuelan-American woman to win Miss USA, which started in 1952. As the winner, Voigt went on to compete in the Miss Universe pageant in El Salvador in November. She placed in the top 20, and for the costume competition, she wore an outfit that featured small models of landmarks, including the Statue of Liberty, the Washington Monument, and the White House. The photographs are extremely strange. Her surprise resignation prompted questions among pageant fans, including those who noticed that the first letters of the first 11 sentences in Voigt's statement spelled out, "I am silenced." the first letters of the final three sentences spell out hip. Does this mean anything? The answer is almost certainly not. But we are a country that takes conspiracy theories very seriously. In a statement on the Miss USA Instagram account, the organization said it respected and supported Voight's decision to step down. The first runner-up at Miss USA 2023 was Savannah Gankiewicz, Miss Hawaii USA. The three other runners-up were from Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Texas. Deep down, she said in her statement, I know that this is just the beginning of a new chapter for me. Well, of course. And my hope is that I continue to inspire others to remain steadfast, prioritize your mental health, advocate for yourself and others by using your voice, and never be afraid of what the future holds, even if it feels uncertain. Okay, which brings us back to this audio. It's some of our favorite audio ever. It is from someone without any mental health problems, it appears to me, unless you consider intelligence a question of mental health. In Miss Teen USA 2007, Miss South Carolina answered a question and answered it unforgettably. It sounded like this.
Okay. Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. Or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I'm not sure how we help the Asian countries by being able to locate the USA on a map. This is apparently she's gone on to great success in a career and in a life as a wife and mother, and but probably not as a geography teacher. That would be a tough connection to make. Speaking of tough connections to make, there's also this question about a conspiracy involving toothpaste tubes. Now, I feel basically ignorant and out of it because I had heard nothing about this, but apparently there are 7.5 million people who have investigated a YouTube that says that basically, toothpaste tubes are printed with secret codes signaling their true ingredients to powerful people. There's a group of dentists recently who took to TikTok to debunk this idea. The idea that there are secret codes on toothpaste tubes, I mean, I guess that's like the first sentences, first letters of the first words in the first sentences of the statement from Miss USA abdicating her throne spells out, I am silenced. Well, we're not going to be silenced, not in this greatest nation on God's green earth.